So I treated Meghan before the royal wedding, but also a lot of other people. And I watched people walking into the church, and it was like a roll call of my clients that I'd seen.
I knew this conversation was going to be special because here I am talking to Sarah Chapman. She's the iconic facialist, the woman behind Skinesis, the skincare brand. She's been at this for, I think, about 25 years. I mean, let's just think about that. That is a long time, a pioneer in the skincare industry. I just love the fact that actually when you talk to these experts and people who have been doing this for decades, it always comes back to some of the most simple, simple lessons about integrity, about honesty, about trust. You know, these are things that you cannot rush. And so Sarah's story, this 25-year story, just really has cemented the fact that building a business, building a dream, building a brand, it just comes from this power of fixating in doing what you love and staying the course and getting through the ups and downs and remaining authentic to the person that you were day one. So I think this is great food for thought and reassurance that there aren't any silver bullets, that the power is within us already. The magic's in us. And I think you're going to love hearing Sarah's story. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Thank you, Sarah, for joining me today. You are Sarah Chapman, and of course, you're the skincare guru, the facialist of the megastars, and you've been dubbed skincare's quiet priestess and are the founder of the award-winning Skinesis, the skincare range, which I don't know if you know, Sarah, but firstly, welcome. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Absolutely honoured to be here. Thank you so much.
I think I mentioned it to you last time we saw each other. I'm a huge fan of your products, and you were the first proper skincare that I ever, I think I bought it. But I mean, this was the hugest deal. This one, I can't remember what it was, but this one pot that I pumped with the oil.
Yes.
And I would not allow myself to wear it except for once a week so that it would last.
Oh, bless you. I know exactly what product that would be. It would have been an overnight facial.
It was the overnight facial.
It would be overnight facial.
Oh my gosh, it's the overnight facial. That takes me back. But you were literally, this was it. I had made it. It's a little bit like when I interviewed Chrissy Rucker. I said, when I bought the first White Company candle, this is it, right? Done. You know,
yeah.
Sort of drop the mic moment. I'm like, I have got a Sarah Chapman skincare, got a White Company candle. Does it get better than this? And so now to interview you, it's just a wonderful, wonderful moment. So I can't wait for our conversation today.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice to hear. And it's so nice to hear that it gave you that experience, because that's what skincare is all about. It's not just about the results. It's also about how it makes you feel.
Yeah.
And you having that product, experiencing using it every night, but also having it in your bathroom.
Yes.
And thinking, oh, I've achieved
this.
I've got this, and it making you feel good.
Yeah.
Makes me feel good. So thank
oh,
you.
Oh, absolutely. And only I wish I could have used it every night, but these were little drops of nectar that I can literally, talking to you, I can smell it right now, because I mean, we're going to get into all of this. It's the smell. It's what, oh my goodness. It just, I realized that this is what great skincare, you know, the essential. Anyway, I'm going to get into this all later, but I just, now talking to you, it really has taken me back. I'm just wondering, we're talking at the end of the summer. Did you manage to get away? Did you rest at all?
I did 4 days.
4 days?
That's all.
Okay.
That's all.
Why is summer so busy for you then?
all time is busy.
Yeah.
So it doesn't sort of make a difference. It's not necessarily that I've been in clinic, but it's been working kind of on lots of other elements in the business. So it's a bit like, you know, summer's approaching. I know it's going to be sort of slightly quieter. So stupidly, I then put every big project I could possibly do with the business into my August plan.
Yeah.
And then it's so busy that I did actually have a couple of weeks booked off at different times, but there were too many things going on. I never managed to go. So I will try to go and take a little bit of a break later in September if I can, even if it's just a week. But yeah, it's got a lot going on with the clinic, but also with the products, with new products launching. We've just developed lots of new professional products to use in the treatment rooms, and everything seems to be bubbling to a head at the same time. So
yeah,
it's needed lots of attention and lots of TLC through the summer months.
I just need to check myself. And like, why are you, you know, particularly busy? I'm like, Holly, what are you talking about? I mean, of course, I'm exactly the same as you. So what? What does summer mean? What does spring mean? These seasons come and go.
I know.
It's still very, very busy. But, you know, sometimes us founders do try and, you know, with the kid, you know, you try and get those spaces of time where you're saying, right, I have to. And I didn't know in your industry if there was a better time, because I can imagine Christmas is a very busy time, but maybe you're just saying it is continuous.
Yeah, I think for me, from my business perspective, it's busy all the time, but there definitely are lulls in the kind of clinic side, because lots of people go away in the summer, but then we also attract lots of visiting people in the summer.
Yeah.
When our regular clients go away, and it's a bit quieter after Christmas, but the lead up to Christmas is crazy because of
yes,
Christmas parties
yes,
and everybody trying to get everything
yes,
done before Christmas. So it is definitely a sort of roller coaster, and it's kind of up and down, but there's a pretty much a consistency of busyness. So
yeah,
that keeps us going. And it's interesting, you know, you say sort of course you're busy, but I know that you're super busy at the moment. You've got lots of projects.
Yeah.
So we talk about conversations of inspiration. You also are hugely inspiring. Obviously, you've had an incredible business before. You've got your business now. But I know the very important things that you're juggling at the moment. So even to find this time
yes,
for us to have a little chat for an hour and a half is very good
aww,
of us. I think we should pat ourselves on the back.
I think so. I've been so looking forward to this. Tell me, when you do, though, recharge, right? So you're saying, and you know, I actually sometimes feel those couple of days can be as good as a great big break, because I sometimes stress out about the big breaks because the amount you have to do before and after. So actually having 2-3 days, we don't feel too guilty. But what is your idea of recharging? You know, I'm assuming self-care is high on your agenda, but what does it look like?
I love to go somewhere where you can actually properly sort of recharge and reset. So I love a good wellness hotel. If I really want to do something that's kind of picking me up off the floor and I need a complete reset, I go to somewhere called Shah Wellness, which does full medical analysis, but they also have fitness. The food is incredibly healthy. You could do just a handful of days and come back feeling like a different person.
Mm.
Or it's just going somewhere near the sea where you can just totally relax, have a bit of sunshine, great food, and definitely some sort of self-care and sort of wellness moments within that. And having time to go to the gym and do some exercise or do some yoga and the things that you don't really get enough time to do in your general day-to-day as much as perhaps you want to.
And what do you feel about September? Because I was just saying to a few people and sort of on Instagram that I do like September as a month, because I do feel, I mean, you're always busy, but I do feel it's like, not your last chance saloon, but, you know, all those intentions. I've got this great big, this year for the first time, every day mapped, you know, in this big, big planner on the wall. And there I was dutifully crossing out every single day. And then I don't know what happened in May, end of May. I just stopped doing it. And I just did it last night. And I realized We've only got these three, four rows left. This is it. So it does feel like a sort of sense of, right, okay, let's get, I don't want to be going back to the 1st of January and not have achieved what I'd set out to do. Do you have the same sort of feeling about your year? Do you set intentions?
Yeah, and I think the September thing is a back to school element, isn't it?
Yes.
Whether you are going back to school or you've got kids that are, or none of that, it's a psychological that's inbuilt in us from all those years where it was the back to school. And you also can look at that last part of the year. Christmas now has a waving hand just around the corner, and you've got that little set time that you know that that's your, as you say, almost last chance.
Yeah.
Get it all done, do the things you want to. I was with somebody yesterday and she was saying the same. She said, I've come back and I've had this really positive conversation with somebody and I said, I want to be motivated and I want to get all this stuff done before the end of the year. So I think it's good. And I think that mostly you have got some sort of recharge from summer, and it might be, you know, I haven't necessarily been away for a big holiday, but it's been gloriously sunny. Mm. Life is a slightly different sort of pace. It feels different. So when you come out of that and you're about to sort of bed down into that last quarter, I think you just sort of draw on your resources and think about what you can achieve so that you finish the year in a great place.
Right. So I'd love to talk to you about little you and going right back to the beginning, because I read when looking into you and your whole world that an incident with your mum's at-home tanning lamp it led you to your earliest thoughts about skincare. I mean, what a sign of the times, a tanning lamp.
Mm.
I mean, just that little thing. Tell me what happened and why it led to your sort of obsession. And you were, I think, a teenager.
That's so funny. I'd almost forgotten about that. I mean, at school, I was very interested as a teenager in makeup and sort of skincare. So I was definitely very experimental with makeup. It was every shade of purple. And if I could match streaks of hair to it and tights and skirt and jumper and everything, and perhaps get some crimping irons to just make the hair even bigger, that was the look. So there was definitely a leaning in towards makeup and stuff at quite a young age. But I do remember my mum had a sort of facial sun lamp. So it sat like a canopy, as you would imagine now, a really good sort of LED treatment that's good for your skin. It was a bit like that.
Yes.
And I was at home for summer holidays, and it had got towards the end of the holiday, and I think I was going back to school the next day. So I sat at the sun lamp thinking, well, I'll just give myself a bit of an extra tan. And I finished the session, and then I thought, oh, well, I won't be able to do it for a while, so I'll do it again. So I basically did a back-to-back session as close as I could possibly get my face to the sun lamp. And actually, I ended up with proper blisters, burns on my chin, with watery, swollen sort of blisters.
Nice look.
Lovely. So I went back to school not looking gloriously sort of glowy and having had a fabulous tan. I went back with sort of weeping blisters on my chin, which wasn't such a good look. So I guess that probably, and also at the time, my parents lived in Norway. So we had very harsh winters, skiing, cold weather. And then the summers were very hot. You were out on the fields, you were in boats, you were in sunshine. So they were always very good about a sunscreen during the summer months, but also thick kind of emollient creams to protect you when you are out in the snow and in the cold.
Yeah.
So I guess that whole phase and time of living got me sort of interested in all of the skincare elements as well as makeup.
Wow, gosh.
So quite interesting. I mean, the creams that we used to use to go skiing were sort of almost like a very thick cold cream. There was this one, I mean, if I smelt it now, it would literally trigger every memory, I think, because it was this one sort of tin pot.
Is it like Vaseline or something?
A bit more like a sort of Nivea type of thick cold cream type thing.
Yes.
But I think actually, when I think about it now, it was probably something like 90% water.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you put that on and you're out in minus 10 degrees, that's probably freezing on your skin. So in actual fact, I don't think it was a very good idea.
But it triggered this thought, because I also read that you loved experimenting with skincare and makeup, and that often your parents' kitchen was, you were creating potions and lotions and balms. You took this into school. Was this your thing? Was this your sort of, you know, when your friends turned to talk about Sarah, Were you the person who was always into all of this? Was that what you were known for?
I think I was known more for the makeup side at school.
Yeah.
And the sort of experimentation with that. It was probably more that than the skincare. And if I was going to spend some pocket money, it was lipsticks and colour in Superdrug,
yes,
as opposed to skincare necessarily. I think the skincare bit sort of started to happen as I came out of school.
Yeah.
Probably more so. But I got very interested in aromatherapy and that kind of side of skincare. And it was one of the courses that I did. I remember at the end we had to do a project. And my project was all about how to make skincare out of natural ingredients.
Mm.
So discovering that oats were very rich in beta-glucans. So if you were to put those on, they're going to be anti-inflammatory. The seeds in strawberries are actually very good for teeth whitening. You know, going back to almost all these old sort of ritualistic ideas of skincare and making masks. I used to make masks and put them on people of eggs and oats and bananas because that was really nourishing.
Right.
And then we all know the old-fashioned egg,
yes,
white would give you the tightening. So I started doing all that sort of stuff. And then I used to order blocks of beeswax, I think, and various different elements and melt them, mm-hmm, in a bowl in mum's kitchen and create creams and lotions and potions. And I had a friend whose granddad was covered in psoriasis quite severely. So had the red underlying sort of irritated skin, mm-hmm, issue and then the really flaky, scaly top section. So I sort of researched what could you put on from all this,
yep,
lovely, wonderful natural world. And I used to make him these pots of balms with different essential oils that would help calm the skin, and he got real benefit from it. So I used to make those up. So then I think that started the whole sort of playing and experimenting.
Yes. How old were you there?
I think I was probably late teenage.
Wow. Okay.
I would say late teenage. Would it be early 20s?
Right.
Yeah. And then I got a book from somewhere, I think it was called like The Fragrant Pharmacy or something, and it had all these recipes in it that you could make balms and creams and cleansers with essential oils and all of the very natural ingredients. So I think that's, my mum's always referring to the fact that I used to make loads of stuff in the kitchen. She would come home from work and then I would need her face so that I could experiment. So she said, I'd come home, I'd have had an exhausting day in the office. And then you'd be like, please, can I put this on your face? And then you'd want to do the makeup and then I'd want to do her hair. So it was a genuine inbuilt passion,
yeah,
I think, from very
it
young.
It sounds
And it's
like
a great
it.
Passion to have because what a great industry
Absolutely.
To be in the end.
Before I move on, I want to quickly ask, were you allowed to wear makeup at school?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, that's good.
There was, I suppose only after a certain age, but definitely in the last couple of years,
oh, yes,
in the sort of teenage age. And I remember that at one of the school sort of evenings where you go to see the teachers and they, you know, tell you whether you've been a bad,
yeah,
or good student. They said to my geography teacher said to my mum, I think Sarah will leave and go and work in Boots. He said, I love every time I've got her in the diary as a class because I never know what she's going to turn up looking like.
Oh, my goodness.
And he said, and she's covered in makeup and it's always something different and I wonder what I'm going to see. So I think she'll go and she'll work at the counter in Boots. And he wasn't far off.
Ish.
Yeah. It was in that world. Yeah.
Well, after school, you moved to London to follow your passion and you trained to be a makeup artist, learning all the aspects of the industry, including, I was interested to see special effects. And am I right in thinking that sort of, I don't know, you were making the balms and the potions and lotions for mum in the kitchen, but this sort of properly opened up the doors and you retrained as a beauty therapist. So you were working close up with models, you know, looking at their skin. And basically that sort of started kicking off this sort of world professionally. Tell me about that period.
Yeah, I mean, when I left school, I had a friend who was from another school and she was a year above me and she came to London and she trained as a makeup artist. I didn't know that such a thing existed.
Right.
Our school careers advice was very sort of general.
What do you remember what they said? Boots, you've got one teacher.
I can remember what they told me. They plugged it all into a system.
Yeah.
What subjects that I'd done at O level, what subjects at A level, et cetera, et cetera. And it came out saying I should be a lorry driver.
I love that question. So many people on this podcast say the most crazy things. Sarah Chapman,
how crazy is
the
that?
The lorry driver.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. Brilliant. Okay.
So very
made up lorry driver. You would have great makeup for the job.
Perhaps I'm delivering skincare and makeup.
There you go.
Something exciting.
There you go. Right. So not a lorry driver.
But yeah, so then I had this friend and she'd come to London and she did this, I think it was only a sort of 3-month makeup course at a college that was all fashion photographic makeup. So I thought, my gosh, this is the best thing since sliced bread. So I came to London and I did the same course. And that basically was the moment that it got me into knowing that there was actually a profession in makeup, skin, all of that. And I spent many years doing different courses and studying. And my dad used to say to me, you've got the rest of your life to work. Study whatever you want to study now. Learn whatever you can learn. Even if you go and do a course basket weaving, it doesn't matter. Just absorb and learn as much as you can. And that's what I did. So I trained in makeup artistry first. I did fashion photographic. And then I went to Australia where I did all the special effects. So there wasn't anywhere in the UK at the time that you could go and train in more film, TV, blood, guts and gore special effects. So it was either going to LA or going to Australia. And I chose Australia. I don't know why at the time. I decided that that was the place to go.
Yeah.
And so I was there, I think, for a year. And we did every type of sort of special effects. We even did some work with like police services and fire services where we would stage a crash in like the Sydney Harbour Tunnel. We were all given various people that we had to make up at stages of injury or death. And then they would plant us all in the tunnel with coaches knocked over and cars and all the different people. And then phone up the services and see how quickly they could get everybody out and fix the situation, basically. So there were situations where I was sort of walking around and somebody would pass me with a piece of glass through their neck or their eyeball falling out, or, I mean, completely not the sort of the glamorous skincare beautiful side, but totally the opposite, but it's fascinating. I did a short horror movie for some movie awards where we were in a wrecker's yard with lots of old cars and I had to make up somebody who'd shot themselves in the head. So we had to talk to forensics to understand what happens to your face, eyes, etc. if you shoot yourself in the head and your eyeball on the other side pops out. So we had to get a fake sort of eyeball and build up latex over the eye and put the eye in and all that sort of stuff. So that was the type of beauty that I was doing when I was in Australia, which was brilliant and I loved it. And I did actually, this is quite funny too, there was one time where we made sort of prosthetic limbs and we made hands.
Yeah.
So you'd make it out of latex modelled on your own hand and then you would build up the sinews with cotton buds and all sorts of stuff and then obviously colour it. So we obviously got to keep those. I wrapped it in lots of tissue into a shoebox as a Christmas present for my mum. And I gave it to her at Christmas. And I said to my dad, when she opens that box, you've got to film every minute. And so, of course, she's opening it all up and the layers and layers and layers. And then suddenly this hand went flying across the room. She nearly had a heart attack. And then it lived in the display cabinet until it disintegrated after about 20 years.
How funny is that? This is not the conversation I thought we would be.
Sorry, yes.
This is the best start to all of this. So when did you go from eyeballs coming out to the model side of makeups and makeup artistry?
Yeah, when I came back to London.
Okay.
So I came back to London and there wasn't really
a need. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, for eyeballs and loose hands. So I kind of went back to what I'd done right at the beginning, which was all the fashion photographic side.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to really get this interest in skin, as you just mentioned a little bit earlier. So it was very pancakey makeup in the days. We were using a lot of kind of almost theatrical makeup. And you would start with somebody's skin that had lots of blemishes, redness, breakouts, and it would be an hour potentially creating the flawless canvas to be able to then do the look that you were trying to create, whether it was a period look, whether it was a
geisha girl, whether it was just a fashion look. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, why can't we sort out the skin first and not have to be putting on these layers and layers of thick concealer and coverage and trying to get the colours right and trying to get the build-up without it then looking bad on camera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that really started that interest into skincare itself and what can we do to make the skin better. That actually means that the makeup side, you can create the looks, but you don't have to do what you had to do with the complexion. But actually after that, it sort of opened me up more to the holistic sort of well-being side. I went and trained as an aromatherapist where I did like full body massage, aromatherapy, which tapped back into those mixing of lotions and potions.
Yes.
And I also did hairdressing actually at one point to complement the makeup artistry. It was never my passion, but I just thought it was an added benefit to creating a look. So it was all about this sort of creating a look. But then the touch piece really came from training in aromatherapy. And in that, I did a very complex course in that where you also touched on kinesiology and lots of techniques that were more than just massage. And then the in-deep sort of clinical aromatherapy. So I spent quite a lot of time in that. And I never really went back into the makeup side.
Yeah.
It's almost like that then took me away.
What I feel has maybe followed you ever since that moment of maybe looking at the model's skin is this wanting to inspire women to be confident within themselves, you know, because when you look back now, you obviously started out, you obviously had this sort of, well, you got lost into skincare. That's where your entire sort of passion obviously was. But the empowerment of women to feel good, has that been a driving force? I mean, we can always connect the dots, can't we, looking back? It's not necessarily when you were that young, was that what you wanted to do, but now at your stage, this many years in, is this something you think that's always interested you?
I think so, because I think there is a huge sort of reward feeling that you get when you make somebody feel better. And I'm sure from very early days, whether it was doing somebody's makeup and making them sort of almost stand up proud and with more confidence and feel better about themselves. I remember some of the earlier sort of shoots when we were building our sort of portfolio as makeup artists. You know, you'd sometimes do on people you knew, or you'd get sort of young models in, and you could see that incredible kind of almost character transformation by creating a look on somebody. So that is quite empowering. And then doing sort of skincare and helping somebody with a problematic skin, or say, for example, you know, making that little potion when I was younger for my friend's grandfather and it helped his skin not itch so much. All of those sorts of things where actually you then feel so good from that.
Yes.
I'm sure that there is because it works both ways. So there's something that happens to you on a physiological level when somebody is getting benefit from something you do and is grateful for it. It triggers something in the brain that gives you the same responses that they get as feeling better, you feel better.
Yes.
And so certainly I would say probably throughout the years, because of everything I've done is really touching onto other people, not myself, but I'm kind of reaping the rewards, if you like, of the benefits of that, because that makes me feel good.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's almost a cycle of...
Yeah. Absolutely.
Making everybody feel good.
Everyone feel good. And I can imagine that, you know, when you started, we were reflecting before the podcast began, because you are basically a pioneer, because we're going back in time and we're going to touch on in a moment the starting points of your business, the Sarah Chapman London business. But you're a pioneer in this entire industry. Before we get into your specific story, I can imagine how many changes you've seen over the last 25 years or so in this world. What do you think the future of beauty holds? Because we are seeing this sort of, well, tell me if you think this is right or wrong, this sort of evolution from maybe about perfectionism to maybe about confidence. But at the same time, we're bombarded with sort of these beauty ideals. You know, we don't see a face that's not filtered. We don't see, you know, what's your response to that? Being that you've seen this for so a quarter of a century, you've seen this, what's your feelings?
I think it's so interesting, isn't it? Because there is a whole sort of movement into you can really be anybody now and express anything about the way that you look, the way that you feel. There's not so much a stereotypical beauty as perhaps there used to be, but still, as you say, everything is filtered and it's changed. And it's so what are we really looking for? What is everybody looking for? I know that in my space, what people come sort of with is much more a well-being aspect now. So I want to look like I'm really healthy. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be perfect. I don't need every line erased. I'm not so worried about those tiny little things anymore. But actually, I want to glow with health and mm-hmm. I want to feel good. So there's a definite link and a movement into how can you make yourself look good to a point that gives you that confidence, but without having to do too much.
Yep.
Because actually, fundamentally, post-COVID time, people are much more aware of their own sort of well-being, their own health. And we know that the skin is a barometer of your health inside. If you don't feel good, if you're not healthy, that shows in your skin. If you're tired, it shows in your skin. Mm. If you're not eating properly, it shows in your skin. You know, your skin is the largest organ. So it really is almost that measure of your kind of levels of health. And people want their skin to be saying, actually, I'm really well, I'm really strong, I'm really healthy. And so I think as that movement continues, people will become slightly less fixated on the individual sort of imperfections, because they won't yep. be necessarily perceived as imperfections yeah. so much anymore.
Yep.
It's
yeah.
okay if you've got a birthmark. It's okay if you've got a little bit of pigmentation. It's okay if you want to express your lines and you don't want to have them all Botoxed away. But if you do want that, that's okay. It's almost like it doesn't really matter now. You can kind of go whichever way feels comfortable for you and makes you actually feel good.
Autumn's in the air, the leaves are falling, and I'm so excited to be back with a brand new series of Conversations of Inspiration. If you're a new listener, a big hello from me and a warm welcome. And if you've been part of this community for many years, welcome back. At Holly & Co, we're not just a small business marketplace, we're a small business marketplace with a purpose. It's our mission to create a more thoughtful way for people to shop, live and work so that we're all better able to show our love for others as well as the world we live in and spend our 29,000 days on this planet doing something worthwhile. From unique handmade gifts for every possible life moment to homeware made to last, everything we sell is carefully curated and supports a UK artist or maker. We also share all kinds of ideas to help you live creatively and all the tools and confidence you need to start your own business if you want one. And not just a good business, but a business that does good. To find out more, just visit holly.co and sign up to our emails. For now, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. So you undertook your training, as we've said, and you were working with different skincare companies, building this sort of incredible base of knowledge. So tell me how you first moved into your work as a facialist, because I heard it happened firstly by accident, which I think many companies do. Although I do think it was fate and the stars were slightly aligned, because I read that your first client was an international royalty. Is this right? Or is this folklore?
No, that sort of is. The first client in my treatment rooms outside my flat.
Right.
So I was already doing treatments from my flat, from the front room.
So when did you start that? Did you just...
So I worked with different skincare companies for a while. I worked for a TV shopping channel, which launched in the UK, which you'll probably know, which was HSN.
Right.
So I was their in-house beauty presenter.
Okay.
So I'd worked with different skincare companies. I was doing bits of TV. And then from my work in the skincare companies, one of my clients who had her own skincare practice, who I used to take the products to and I used to talk to her and train her in new products, etc., for this brand. She moved to Australia and she said to me, could you look after some of my clients? Because I'm going to go and live in Australia for a while. And I said, I don't really do that anymore. I'm sort of doing all these other things. And anyway, she persuaded me. So I literally took on maybe three or four of her clients. She didn't know when she was going to come back from Australia, but she said, "You're the only person that I trust. We used to have these great sessions. We were very like-minded." And she'd been doing treatments for a long, long time. And that really was just me at home in my flat doing these guys, who then told their friend, who told their friend, who told. And it was a very typical word of mouth. I never set out to grow a facial practice. That wasn't the intention. It happened naturally, which is quite beautiful in its own way, because it happened because people loved what I was doing. And then I got really into it, and then it developed more. And I was doing that from home until I decided that it was becoming too much to do at home. And I took a room up in Draycott Avenue near South Kensington. And it was when I took that space and I was doing the building works, because I had to repaint it and stuff. Nothing big, but I had to tart up the space. And I had Queen Rania of Jordan as my first client, and she was booked in. And I used to go in every day to those builders and say, "You absolutely have to finish on time. You have to finish on time.
And the place can't stink of paint."
Exactly. And we made it happen.
You made it happen.
Because you can make anything happen, right, if you put yourself to it. So we made it happen. So she was the first client for me up the stairs in my little first treatment room outside of home. And then it really grew from there. So I had one room, and then I got too busy. I was doing 7 days a week, but I couldn't fit anybody else in. So I took on a second therapist and I trained her. And then I got another room in the building and we took on somebody else. And then I got to four people and I managed to get three rooms in the building, which is this fabulously higgledy-piggledy building next to Daphne's. And you'd hear people clinking away the champagne at lunchtime while you were doing a facial. And it was just really, really beautiful space, actually. And then we reached a point where I had 250 people on the waiting list that I couldn't get in for a facial, which now to me seems crazy. This is a long time ago now, because I've had the clinic in Pavilion Road is 11 years now. So this was pre that time. And I thought, I've got to set up a bigger space. So I started looking. It took me a few years to find the right space, because I wanted to have a clinic practice that had windows in all the treatment rooms. So you had natural light for two reasons. One is because we're dealing with skin and I want to be able to see the skin properly, not in a dark room in a basement with one magnifying lamp.
Yes.
And secondly, it's a hard job doing what we do. And it can be long hours, and I didn't want the people working with me to, again, not see daylight for 10 hours a day. We want to, so again, it's almost touching into that, actually, it's the well-being of the people we're working with and myself. I don't want to be in the dark, but also what's the best for our client? It's being able to see the skin. Yes. So it took a long time to find that space, but we did. We found the clinic, which we're now in Pavilion Road. Which actually also, when we moved to that, so I had 250 people on the waiting list for treatments. I think by this point I had maybe 7 or 8 products in the range.
Oh, right. Okay. Because I want to go back to that, about the start of this.
Sorry. Yes, yeah, so I had launched that. And the space that I found that I loved had this huge shop underneath, but I only had 8 products. And we weren't allowed to put any treatments downstairs. No reception, nothing to do with the clinic. That was all upstairs.
Yeah.
So I looked at this sort of empty shell of a shop and thought, what am I going to do with this space? So actually we built little hubs for skin camera analysis, a theory bar. We could do masterclasses, mini sort of treatments, you know, all of the experiential stuff, which now is what everybody's doing. But strangely, it wasn't because I was necessarily so advanced and ahead of my time. I just had to think of something to fill the shop.
It's always the way, though. It's these, I think it's, you know, everyone's like, genius. You're like, yeah, genius. That's right. But actually, as you said, you just needed to fill the shop. And so many of our stories will have that element of, you know, almost experimentation or the just doing something because you just had to do it. And then that becoming the thing. I mean, you said you had 8 products by this stage. Tell me about the start of Skinesis, because you've spoken about how it felt like a natural evolution, because you're now in your premises where you've got 3-4 people and potentially you're using other skincare brands. Yes.
Yes.
It must have been started like that. So it probably, you probably weren't able to maybe find what you needed.
Yeah. So I was working with different skincare brands and mixing lots of things together. So I had some really kind of brilliant cosmeceutical technical skincare, which was really delivering the results that we needed in the facials and for people's skin. But I was also buying like Santa Maria Novella rose water from Florence or mixing up essential oils from something else, because I'd gone from working with a very aromatherapy-based skincare, French aromatherapy-based skincare, to a very technical plastic surgeon's kind of cosmeceutical range with lots of retinoids and vitamin A and antioxidants. And I used to mix everything together so that when I was doing this very technical results-driven treatment, the client was also experiencing the smells and the textures and the hands-on part of what was the types of treatments that I did before. And I had a client of mine who came in one day, and I was already thinking, this idea was already sort of bubbling in my head. And she came in and she said, I had a friend to stay at the weekend, she said. And she went into the bathroom, and she was a great storyteller. She went into the bathroom, she took this big pot, she said, and it had this heavy lid. And she said, and she opened the lid as she sort of did this movement with her hands and stuck her fingers into this big pot and lavished it on her face. And she said, I watched her and I felt so jealous because the product that you're giving me to take home, I want to hide away in the cupboard. It's smelly, it's sticky, it's not great, but I know, and I had going around my head, that I'm going to look so much better than her in 20 years' time because I had your voice in my head telling me what that product was doing for me. She said, so why can't my product that's delivering the results make me feel like her product was, which was beautiful and luxurious and unctuous and it smelt great and she had this heavy jar and it was all lovely. And even though it's not going to do as much for her as what you've given me, I felt really envious and I thought, why can't you have that together?
Yes.
Why can't you have a skincare product or a skincare range that's primarily about giving you the results? So it's almost clinically led in terms of its ingredients, its performance, its formulation. But at the same time, every time you use it, every time you put it on, every time you experience it, you get that incredible feel-good factor. And that was essentially the little nugget that then sat in my head and wouldn't go away. And because it wouldn't go away, eventually I thought, I've got to try and do something with this. I didn't know where to start. I hadn't run a business. I didn't know even how you started to formulate. So I went and studied cosmetic science so that I could understand laboratory speak and understand what, you know, a machine that makes an emulsion, how does that work? What happens? How do I look at a inky list on the back of a box and really understand it? So I took the kind of the hands-on that I'd done for all those previous trainings and everything that I'd done, I then added in cosmetic science so that I could really sort of build it all out to develop something that I genuinely believed in.
Some people would just have gone to the manufacturers, or maybe today that's what some people do, you know, but you basically went and studied it as if you were going to literally be mixing these pots up yourself. But that is, do you feel, I want to carry on with this story, but you as a person, are you obsessed with sort of knowing it all? Like, as in, like, literally every ingredient? It wasn't going to be someone, you go to someone and say, listen, I just want, you know, some anti-aging, I like this smell, da-da-da-da. You wanted to know every single element of it. Do you think that sort of what I call founder-titis has stood you in good stead?
Absolutely. And I think I never knew it before I did it. You'll sort of understand that. It's almost like,
once, again, a hindsight.
I'm like, I didn't realise that I had this like obsessive attention to detail. I didn't realise that I was such a perfectionist. I didn't know that those traits were in me. I really didn't. And I think that that's something that has kind of come through as I've done the business. And that absolute kind of thirst for knowledge. I'm very inquisitive. So tell me something, but I want to understand how or why you're telling me that, or, okay, so prove it, rather than, oh yeah, that sounds nice, okay, we'll do that. And I don't think, so because I'd worked with such incredible skincare brands with my clients before, my philosophy in my head was, whatever I do has got to be so much better than these, because otherwise, firstly, I may lose all my clients because mm-hmm. they'll say, well, I don't mm-hmm. want that because I'm going to go to somewhere else mm-hmm. that does the products that you had before. And secondly, I don't want them to spend their money and not get the results that they're looking for. So it's sort of like, it was almost, I felt like I wanted to protect them in some sort of way. And the only way that I could do that was to make sure that whatever I developed was going to be better than all the things that I'd been using. So then I had to understand how and why I was going to do that. So doing the cosmetic science gave me that deeper insight. So when I was dealing with chemists, I never took no for an answer.
Yeah.
If they said, well, you can only have 0.04% in, I'd say, but I know you can have more than that. And I need more than that because that clinically is going to give me the result that I need.
Yes. Gosh.
So I think there are obviously in many cases, people will go to a formulation lab or contract manufacturer and do something in a much simpler way mm-hmm. for sure mm-hmm. and say, I want to have a product that's X, Y, Z. And they may even take something that's already developed off the shelf. I did probably the complete polar opposite to that and did the most complicated journey that I could have done. And actually, it took 4.5 years to create the first 6 products.
I know, I read that. I was going to say 6 products took 4.5 years. I mean, which, you know, ultimately is probably unheard of these days. But those were your sort of brand-defining products. I'm interested, in those early days, sort of doing this and launching it, did you believe, how did you get your confidence in, because again, we're talking when no one else was doing this, really. I think nowadays, we've got a lot of skincare going on. But if you think when you started, no one else really was doing this. You were now in case anyone doesn't know, Sarah, am I right in thinking your clinics now carry out 16,000 facials a year?
Yes, roughly that. Yeah.
And a 4-month waiting list. So for everybody who doesn't know Sarah, this is what we're talking about here. So tell me about that confidence in launching this and sort of knowing that this was the future for you.
Do you know what's so interesting is I never doubted it and I don't know why.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't an overly confident person. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I had this idea and it was so clear to me and I think I was so passionate about it. To me, it was just about how do I do it?
Mm.
It was never about can I? It was never about
whether it was right or wrong.
Yeah, it was much more about just how I've got to find the way to do it. And I think that there were many people that said to me at the time, you're mad, are you crazy? How are you going to go up against the Estee Lauders and, you know, the big brands? Because that's really all there was around at the time. There wasn't all the niche brands that we see now coming out all the time. And it's much easier to launch something nowadays as an independent. But I just had this very clear vision. So something in me, I couldn't explain why, but just kept me on this path that I even had sort of friends who after a while are like, I'd have so given up 2 years ago. Your tenacity is unbelievable.
Annoying.
Yeah, yeah. But I just,
that with my friends. It's like, yeah. God, give it up already. Yeah. Come on, I cannot hear this anymore.
Why? We can still do it. And I think, you have something and you just keep going. And I worked with, I think, probably 4 different companies in the UK who I tried to create the products with. I was so clear what I wanted with the products. Some were independent chemists, some were contract manufacturers with development labs and chemists in-house. And I couldn't get the products how I wanted them. I couldn't get the level of concentration of actives in them that would give me the performance. I couldn't get the products so that they were stable enough with those actives in them. I didn't want to use parabens, which was a new consideration at the time. So there wasn't a lot available without
parabens. What's that?
Parabens. So parabens are a type of preservative.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want synthetic fragrance. I wanted to use essential oils because of my aromatherapy background.
Mm.
But I wanted to create those in a very unique way. So they smelt more like a fragrance rather than like a bathing essential oil brand.
Yeah.
But there were so many things that happened in the formulations because they were so concentrated in terms of the active ingredients, plus all of these other elements, that sometimes a sample would arrive and it would smell literally like sulfur, like rotten eggs. Another time it would arrive and the mold would be growing and it'd be broken and it had only been made 3 days before and transported. Mm. It was so difficult to get the formulations right. So I tried over, I think, the course of about 4 years, well, it must have been 3.5 in the UK. And then I went to the US. I just thought, I got introduced to somebody. I had a conversation with him. He was so on my wavelength as a chemist. I got on a plane to San Francisco and he said, if you prove you're serious, get on a plane, come over here. I'll give you my two best chemists for a week. And I went in the lab with them and we pretty much hammered out the first six products.
Wow.
We'd already done a lot of work on them.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it
yeah.
Was,
yeah. But you, yeah. It's interesting that because when you were telling me that story, I think about so many times through my career that I've known what I've wanted and then you hire the experts, you know, so you go there because of course they'll know because you don't know, but you know what you want. And I've been so surprised how many times that just hasn't worked. I mean, really, I mean, I would say almost nearly 80% of the time it hasn't worked. What I've actually had to do is almost go back to the drawing board and just basically do it myself, do it with my team. And even though we didn't have the expertise in it, we just had to take longer. It was much harder as a journey, but ultimately it was the thing that you wanted at the end. It was actually, and in that way, the USP was already inbuilt because it was just not off the shelf. And I think we tend to look for the silver bullet, or we tend to look for, you know, of course someone else must have done this or they must be the experts. But actually sometimes getting the marigolds on and actually literally doing it yourself with no, you did have knowledge, by the way. I'm not saying you didn't have knowledge, but you know, that sort of, you tend to not start there because you go, of course other people have got this, you know, of course. But actually so often, 80% of the time that I've started new projects, we've just ended up going back to doing it and learning it and teaching ourselves it.
I think because you're the one who's got that inbuilt vision and passion, and you can try to kind of get that with somebody else, but there's something that's built in you, I think, if you do this entrepreneurial journey that is hard to, and you've got to keep that route almost driving everything, haven't you?
Yes.
And yes, you can have people who've got their expertise because you need to, but in those early days, you kind of have to keep going back and you have to stay so strong and true to what you believe in. Mm. You know, there were lots of things during the kind of development of the product. So Overnight Facial, we mentioned earlier on.
Yes.
So Overnight Facial.
Was that one of your first products?
Was one of the first six.
Yes, so there I was. And I was there at the beginning.
You were right there. You were right there. And it's actually been the number one seller for 16 years. It is the number one product that brings people into the brand, that people absolutely fall in love with. And it almost encompasses everything that the brand is about.
Yeah.
When I was developing that product, I wanted to call it Overnight Facial and everybody told me not to call it Overnight Facial.
Why?
Everybody told me not to because they said it's nobody will understand what it is. It needs to stay, it's a night cream or a night serum.
Oh, okay.
Nobody will understand it. So in the end, I thought, no, I like the name. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So I think it's, I think you've got to stay sort of true to yourself and you've got to stick to what it is that you believe in. Everybody told me my packaging should be white because scientific skincare is white.
Yes.
I didn't want it to be white. I had this taupe vision in my head and so I did it.
Well, didn't you have a jumper and a piece of ribbon?
I did.
You had a jumper and a piece of ribbon that inspired you and no one said that you should have this colour. And until you found an ability to basically launch with this colour, you weren't launching.
Yeah, I had to get the colour. And unfortunately, it's not a Pantone colour reference. So it's really difficult to match it and to get the right colour. So yes, I think it's, I think you have to be brave. And I don't know where that bravery came from. I don't think I had a big sort of ego. It wasn't an ego driving it. It wasn't being sort of believing that I knew better than anyone else. It was purely a vision. And it was a vision that was so strong. I knew how it was going to look from way in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just getting those formulas right, getting those products right, and then trying to get everything else into place with it as well. So I think it's, you've got to just keep on that path yourself, I think.
Yeah.
And I had so many people that kind of said, I really would totally have given up. I really wouldn't have stayed through that journey. And when we did finally launch, my boyfriend's friends at the time didn't know anything about what I was doing. And they all turned around. And I went from sort of being this just kind of, I was in beauty and I was always out with friends and having a great life and young and drink too much and whatever else. And then suddenly I launched this thing and all of them were like, what on earth is going on? And I think one of them termed me like the silent assassin or something. It's like, where did this person come from? But I think you literally put yourself into a sort of tunnel and you just keep going. And I think if I ever doubted what the concept was, I probably would have stopped at some point.
Yeah, well, it's that belief, isn't it? I mean, would you say, because you've mentioned that sort of, unless you got the colour right, you weren't launching, it was just that I wanted a milligram more of this and a mil more of this and all those sorts of things. You know, we often talk about perfectionism as being a bad thing. You know, like if you want to go and look at some, you know, Instagrammy, Pinteresty quotes, you know, it's better to get done than perfect and, you know, all these sorts of things. But what's your view on perfectionism in terms of, like, has that been something that you've been comfortable with?
I think so, because I think perfectionism, even if you're not quite there at it being perfect, but you're striving for it, you're going to have something pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm.
So you might not quite get to perfection, but you're going to get to something that's really close. And actually, if you're doing something, you know, I'm doing scientific skincare, it's got to be with that attention to detail. It has to be of a certain level in order to be a product that will perform for people, but also that's safe for people to use. There are so many different elements to it. I think, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I always say, you know, you should celebrate all your failures and don't worry about being a perfectionist and things can go wrong and it doesn't matter if it's not quite right. I can't live that way. That's not in me.
Yeah,
it's got to be right.
Got to be right.
And it's got to be absolutely perfect. And that just is natural to me. So it doesn't bother me that I feel like that about things.
Yeah.
And I'm that really, really annoying person that sees every spelling mistake. And I don't try to.
Yeah.
And my team are always like, oh my God, four of us have read it. And then you get it. And now
so
look.
Annoying.
And I can't, it's just there. So I say embrace it and make it useful. Because ultimately, you know, it's not a bad thing to be a perfectionist. If it suits you to be one.
If it's in your DNA, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're now many, many years on from launching those six products and you've got a beautiful collection of products and each and every one is created, obviously with this clinical side, but your customer experience, your award-winning, you've got cult status. You happen to be London's one of the, you know, sought-after facialists. And again, for those who don't know, Victoria Beckham, Duchess of Sussex, to name a few. But you've seen the industry evolve in these 25 years and this sort of technical high-tech treatments and sort of trending ingredients, you know, it gives me palpitations, I have to say, because, I mean, and you can almost say it's not just skincare, is it? It's our diet as well, you know, or the next vitamin that we should be taking. Does that ever feel as though innovation can be sort of a fine line to walk? And sort of how do you navigate that? Because I don't know, like, I just, you know, I think social media is fantastic when you build a business and you're building yourself, aren't you, as a person. But I can't keep up as a woman who wants to be in the wellness, you know, have the most healthy body, healthy face. I'm a skincare fanatic, all these sorts of things. But I literally can't go a week without feeling like I'm failing because I'm not taking this or I haven't put that on. Or is that skincare brand duping me? Because actually it's all made, I don't know where. But I really thought I knew what I was talking about. We're sort of, how are you navigating with your brand, this sort of era that we're living in?
Yeah, because that's such a shame, because that's something that should be kind of joyous and should be enjoyable and making you feel good is actually making you feel insecure, negative, that you don't feel like you know what's going on and unsure. It's like I would always say, you know, we would never say to somebody, oh, don't use that product, it's not very good, because you've suddenly made somebody's whole kind of lifestyle choice.
Yeah.
Insulted, and that's essentially insulting them. So it's about finding ways to kind of talk to people about things. But it's interesting that you feel like that. It is such a complicated space.
Yeah.
There is so much noise. There is too much available on social media. And there's a lot of untruth on social media. And we all know that across every element. And there's loads of stuff about social media that's brilliant. Mm. But how does somebody dissect what is right and what's not if they don't have superior skincare knowledge, for example, or superior supplements and health knowledge? We all have to sort of take a bit of what we're listening to, and we have to try to bring it in some sort of way that makes sense for us. I think that for me, what I'm seeing quite a lot, and what a lot of people are saying that I talk to, is the era of the expert is what is kind of happening. So if you look at something, whether it's me with my skincare or a chef who's super experienced or whatever it is, look for something that's coming from somebody with expertise, because there's been a lot over the past years where it's people who've got maybe a name or an interest or whatever it is, but not necessarily the true expertise behind something. And somebody was saying to me the other day, you know, heritage brands, brands that have been around for a long time, are the brands that now people are really trusting, because you've actually sort of stayed the test of time, which means your product is working. It's doing something for people. Otherwise, it wouldn't still be here. But also there's learnings along that sort of journey, if you like, in terms of what you're delivering. And if there's an expertise behind it, no matter what field it is, you know that you've got something that's got much more credibility. Therefore, trust in that and listen to that more so than maybe something else.
Yeah.
But I think for you, in terms of skincare, is probably what a lot of people feel. It's like, am I a peptide, a retinoid, an antioxidant, a stem cell, a vitamin C? What am I supposed to be putting on? This is my age. Does it matter my age? This is my skin. Is it about my skin? We always try to talk to people about trying to set yourself a good routine that's something that you do all the time. Mm-hmm. Something that you find a cleanser that suits your skin and kind of respects your skin and doesn't strip it. You find the thing that's right for you. You use a serum, and that chops and changes depending on what's going on with your skin. You know, you've just come back from summer. It's a bit blocked. It's going to need something different to the middle of winter, where it's really dehydrated and it's desperately thirsty for some hyaluronic acid and hydration. And you've got your moisturizer and protection. And then you play around that. So I kind of think of those elements. It's your underwear. Every day you've got your underwear on, but it could be a flimsy dress in the summer, or it could be a cashmere outfit with a raincoat in the winter. So you've always got your core, which is going to hold you together and is your absolute.
Yep.
And then play around with other things that interest you, that you feel are right for your skin, but then you're never coming away from the fundamentals of keeping your skin healthy.
I love that.
And I think that's the key way to sort of play it.
I love that. I mean, the beauty industry as a whole has just seen this huge growth, as you just were saying, in terms of different things coming, different people, different brands coming in. And I was a little surprised to read that it makes up over 1% of the entire country's GDP. It contributes more than sports and recreation and employs more people than publishing and broadcasting industries, which is nuts. I saw that the British Beauty Council published a piece last month announcing that the government has committed to introducing increased legislation in
the aesthetics industry. So injectables, doctors, it's become a bit of a wild west, you know, the in terms of the whole injectable space. And I think people are really concerned about that. And the British Beauty Council, I work with the British Beauty Council. They're an incredible body that are really campaigning government to make safety a priority, particularly in this area, but across a lot of the beauty industry. And also highlighting those things that you were just saying about how important the beauty industry is to the economy.
Yeah.
It's massively important here. And I think sometimes that isn't realized, because beauty is a beautifully fluffy, lovely, wonderful industry, but actually it's a serious place that is doing serious treatments and actually delivering great revenue to the economy. So there's so much more to it than the fluff and beauty that people can see on the surface level. The aesthetics industry has absolutely boomed, and I think particularly since COVID. I mean, injectables, what people are asking for, how many aesthetics clinics are opening. I mean, it's a completely different landscape to pre-COVID times.
Why do you think that is, Sarah?
I think it was everybody coming out of that time and just suddenly thinking about themselves and what they were going to do and how they're going to look and their health and their well-being and prioritizing themselves in no matter which way. So then I think there is so much more available to see on social media, TV programs.
Yeah.
Wherever you're looking, you can see somebody who's having some injections done or some surgery done. It's like an interesting thing for people. So I think it's normalized it. If you talk to somebody years ago about fillers and Botox, it was a much more under the radar. If somebody had it, they didn't really tell people that they had it.
Yeah.
You know, it was much more a hidden away secret to looking a little bit better. Now it's loud and proud about the fact that you've had your Botox, et cetera. And people are starting it so much younger.
I was going to say, that's the thing that's just shocking. I mean, you must have found this incredible, that how young people are doing these treatments or having these changes, and that they're allowed to have them.
Yes.
Is this what they're looking to do, trying to put regulation in for age? Or
I think, you know, people in their 20s are doing a lot in terms of injectables, which so it's starting much younger, and it's a certain look that people are trying to achieve quite a lot now. I think a lot of the campaigning and the regulation is to try and make sure that if people are going and having these sorts of treatments, that they're done by people who are properly trained, using the right products, and it's regulated. Because people can buy the substances online. You don't know what's in it. You don't know what they're injecting into somebody's face. And there have been some terrible stories where people have had very bad situations from having injections where it probably wasn't what it was supposed to be. So I think really the whole campaigning, as this part of the industry is booming, is about trying to get safety into the place by putting in the regulations.
Lots of people listening could be thinking about starting their business or have started a business or know someone. When I speak to you, it's this sort of, I love what you said, these heritage brands, you know, brands with substance, brands with roots, brands that have stood the test of time. As you said, you wouldn't be here if it wasn't working. Do you think that that's something that you have brought into your brand? I mean, apart from, or do you think it's the product? What do you think is the success of your brand? Is it that you know what you're talking about, you are the expert, and you've just built off that? Because a lot of people right now will be looking, because we are in this sort of fast fix sort of position. You know, we can start up a business really, really quickly if we want to. You can get onto Instagram, you can get out there, you can claim what you want to maybe claim. But ultimately, the hardcoreness of what you want to do, you know, that be here for the next 20 years, there's some key fundamental things. What do you think those have been for you? Would you say perfectionism was one of them?
Sort of, but I'd say it's more about honesty and integrity. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't tell you how many times people say to me, I will always buy something of yours because I trust you. Yeah. So I think building trust through not telling the truth, never overstating something, being just very clear and honest about your advice, direction, whatever it is, so that you over time build that trust with people. People always kind of say, you know, we know if we come to you that whatever you do is safe. We trust it, whether it is coming to see a doctor in your clinic or whether it is a product that we're going to buy from you. We trust that it's well thought through, and we feel safe with it. So I think you can't make that happen overnight. That sort of happens over time. And I'm very much of the belief that you're always honest. You have integrity in everything that you do. And those are really core values to me. So I suppose they come through in everything that we do.
And it helps that you're still there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm still there and I'm still very involved. So it's still very much the same. I guess, as it was right in the early days. And people know that and they can feel that. Mm. And sometimes clients will say to me, you know, when I take my bottle of product and I put it on, they say, I can almost feel you in the bottle.
Wow.
The detail of everything in it, it's just you. So I think there is such a strong connection to who I am and what I'm about in the product, because there is so much care and attention taken to developing those, that that makes a difference. And I think over time, yeah, it's really about that consistency always then suddenly develops the trust and the belief in the brand.
The little steps, maybe.
Yeah.
The little steps of all those trust elements that we don't sort of realize, you know, that when we share something maybe on Instagram and we have that packaging with that extra piece of copy at the back, and you do sign up to that standard, or you do this, and you think that these are all small drops, but ultimately, I mean, you're the example here, it all adds up to something very big, because it adds up to basically the word trust, and trust can't be bought. Trust has to be earned.
Absolutely.
And I think that is what, if anyone's listening and you're thinking about this, go the hard miles. I mean, go slower than faster. You said that you're the...
I'm that sort of slow coach or slow tortoise. And we're just sort of going along, doing it how we do it. We'll get there. We're not coming and suddenly we're huge and loud and everything's happening. But we're getting there, but in our own way, without pressure. You know, we've never had any investment in the business. It's very much kind of controlled. And it's about really doing everything with that focus on doing it properly and that real sort of integrity in everything, whether it's a treatment, whether it's talking to a client, whether it's developing a product.
Did you know that Royal Mail have refreshed their small business hub on royalmail.com? The Small Business Hub contains relevant product information, insight, articles, tips, tricks, and more with small businesses like you in mind. You may even see me pop up there from time to time. Why not take a look and remember to keep popping back as it's regularly updated? You can find the Small Business Hub at royalmail.com/smallbusinesshub. I'd love to know what your family looks like and how blending your family and being a very busy woman who didn't take many days off for summer, how does that fare?
Well, I don't have children, so that makes it a little bit easier, but I have two dogs who are like children.
Yes.
And I have a very close relationship with my parents, so I spend a lot of time with them. And then my partner, who I've been with for, I don't know, 20-something years. So my life is very much... priority mostly, most of the time, is work. Work is the kind of orcus, but it always has been. So for me, that's normal. And sort of dogs and friends and life and parents, really.
Yeah. And do you find that what's your point of view? Because I often have a conversation about not just work life. I mean, I'm just very not bored of that subject. I'm past the sort of work life, and anyone listening to this podcast over the last 5 years knows my points of view on that. But what's your point of view in saying, you know, work is my thing. You know, this is what I do. It's what I feel like it's, you know, this is your world. I feel exactly the same. What I do is my world. It's my 360. And so, you know, you've got your name on a bottle and I've got my name on a website, you know, so it really is us. What's your point of view when people sort of potentially over the years have questioned that?
Yeah, so I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it? Because
but you must have had people.
Yeah,
right?
It is, I suppose, my passion, and it is kind of what I do. And I don't really know it any other way. I started working for myself 25 years ago or something. So I don't really know what life would be like if it wasn't like that. I can't imagine what I would do if I didn't have the business.
Yeah.
I don't know what I would do with the hours in the day, but I also don't know where I would get that stimulation and reward. And I also have the most privileged job in that I treat people for facials. I meet the most amazing people from around the world. I wouldn't meet them if I just stayed in my local space with my great friends, because they wouldn't be tapping into this network of people. So I learn and I absorb and I grow every day by naturally being with these kind of people. So I think that you know, my work feeds me in so many ways and I put a lot into my work, but that's a beautiful cycle of life. And I can't imagine it really any other way. And I think, you know, everybody is different, aren't they? So for some people, that wouldn't be their passion. It would be something else, or they wouldn't find the space within the time that we all have to have a business like this because they've got other things that they would prefer to prioritize. And I think that's the beauty of the world. Everything is different and everybody's different. Yeah. And that's what makes variety and conversation and everything around us happen.
Amen. A women.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Love it. Absolutely love it. We're coming towards the end of this podcast. And I end all of my interviews with the analogy that this is like being on a roller coaster. And it's, isn't it unbelievable? But it is full on at times. What would you say has been one of your biggest lows, Sarah, whilst you've been on this journey?
Hey, it's interesting, isn't it? Lows. Because funny, you have them all the time, don't you? You have this, as you absolutely say, a roller coaster. And you can have everything suddenly seems to be going really well and boom, it's back down again. And it's back down again. And there's this constant up, down, up, down, up, down. I think that probably, and it's probably the same for a lot of people with a business, the time of COVID was a big low. It was very hard to go through COVID where suddenly everything was taken away. My clinic was shut for 11 months in total, which is nearly a year. That's a huge amount of time. I've got a team of 32 in the clinic. My biggest priority was making sure at the beginning that they were all okay, because lots of them are young girls that live on their own. They didn't have somebody with them. How were we going to manage through that? What were we going to do? We set up daily sort of training classes, you know, but none of us knew obviously how long it was going to go on for.
Yeah.
Not only was it sort of the challenge of managing all of that, but obviously financially it was a difficult time. Luckily, because I've always been a squirreler and a saver in the business. I've never been a person that takes from the business. There was plenty of money. I never had to have a moment where I thought, we're not going to survive because we just, but it meant that we used a lot of the savings, which is a shame because they would have gone towards clinic number two or something else that we wanted to do. But I didn't have that really horrible feeling that a lot of people had in terms of that.
Would we survive?
I think that probably that period of time was difficult. And also because so much of what we do is connection with people.
Yes.
And there was no connection with people.
Yeah, I know.
I wasn't doing any facials. I wasn't seeing anybody. That for so many people was difficult, wasn't it?
Did your online sales though boom?
Online sales really boomed at the beginning and then it all plateaued as it sort of went on and on, I think as with most people. And that was obviously a great advantage. So everybody in the product business, we were all just working at home. So we were all busy every day. We were doing the same. We were just doing it in a different sort of way.
Yeah.
It was really the clinic where that you couldn't continue working in the same capacity because of the nature of the business.
Yeah,
so
it
did mean that, we picked up certainly in some of our sort of sales and the business through all the online activity with the product side, which was great.
And conversely, with amazing skin, you're at the top of the roller coaster, sun on your face, but with the correct SPF on, what would you say has been the greatest high?
I'd say there's probably been loads of those. I mean, if I think about literally the first time I saw the product on the shelf in Space NK, that was such a huge moment. And I stood in the shop. I was with a friend of mine, I think, and I stood in the shop and I watched and somebody bought one. I mean, that, after 4.5 years of creating the product, Space NK being my favorite beauty shop and such an iconic place and a place to launch. That was an incredible moment. But there's been lots. There's also, I think of times where you mentioned earlier about, you know, treating the types of people that I treat. So I treated Meghan before the royal wedding, but also a lot of other people. And I watched that wedding and I watched people walking into the church and it was like a roll call of my clients that I'd seen, you know, and I was sitting with my mum and dad and the sort of proud moments of, well, did you see the, yes, I did them on Tuesday. Did you, you know, because you can say it at home with your mum and dad, but you can't say it anywhere else because I don't talk about the people
but
that I treat.
That
was an incredible moment.
Maybe a designer, a fashion designer, be like, that's my skirt, that's my coat. But you're literally looking at the glow. That's my skin. That little cheek here, I did that. Or, you know, look at the dewy glow. Yes, that's me again.
Yep. Yeah.
How funny that you pick out the skin. The skin walking up the aisle. I mean,
it doesn't actually look great today.
Sure does.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
So lots of moments like that all the way through. Absolutely.
So
there's a lot of highs. And you've got to have the highs. They pick you up from the lows. You know, as you know, sometimes there's challenging times where you just not got the right people around you or something happens. You know, we were launching a new product earlier this year, new vitamin C serum. We had it all lined up. We had a vitamin C serum, a vitamin A serum. Space NK were doing a big launch for us. For once, we'd done everything well in advance. We were all feeling really good. We kind of all went to Christmas going, ha, 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 we've got it. We've done
it
this time.
Look how we progress
Brilliant.
Now. Look at us.
Yeah. We got into the early part of the year and the truck that was bringing all of the stock, the vitamin C stocking, got stolen. All the stock got stolen at gunpoint. So the truck got stopped. The guy was held up at gunpoint. They took all of the serums.
What do you do, Sarah, in these times?
Exactly.
I've never heard of the stealing skincare.
I think it's actually becoming a thing. I'm sorry to say.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was so desirable, we never got it.
That could have been your ad campaign.
So, yeah.
So good it's held up at gunpoint.
Yeah. So once we'd sorted the driver and everything else that was going on, we obviously had to speak to Space NK about the fact that we didn't have the stock, and then we had to go into a whole cycle of reordering packaging, replanning, etc. So that was a pretty bad moment this year, I think.
Yeah, I can imagine. Not one that you can ever predict. It's like, I always think it's like a soap opera.
Yeah.
Like EastEnders. Do you know what I mean? Like running your own business is like EastEnders. You just don't know what the dun-dun-dun is going to be.
And people don't believe the stories. They believe them, but they don't. They're just like, what? What? But you've got to find ways to pick yourself away from that. Yeah. And I guess I'm quite a problem solver, and I think you have to be, and you become one when you have a business. You'll know that too.
Yes,
so
you do.
Something happens and actually you don't dwell on that. You figure out what's the way to move it forward and to solve the problem.
I know so many, Sarah, will be really inspired listening to this podcast. And thank you so much for just sharing and just allowing us to hear your journey. It's that stage of the podcast where I'm going to ask you to read a letter to your younger self that you've prepared before. It's my greatest moment to hear these letters, and I'm really looking forward to hearing yours.
Oh, thank you. So it's an interesting thing to do, to write a letter to your younger self. And I have listened to quite a few of yours, so I hope that this one doesn't disappoint and is interesting. It sort of touches into quite a lot of the things that we've talked about today. So I'll start.
Thank you.
So, dear Sarah, the life ahead of you is bigger and more beautiful than you can imagine. I see you now, a quiet, shy little girl, often nervous, always observing, and more comfortable listening than speaking. What you don't yet realise is that this gentle observation, this way of watching the world, will one day become your greatest gift. In those moments of standing back and noticing everything, you are learning and absorbing, and that sensitivity, that awareness of detail, will one day shape the way you understand people, skin, and beauty, and will form the foundation of everything you do. Then come your teenage years, where shyness turns to rebellion. You cover yourself in makeup, layering it on like armour. You don't yet know that your fascination with textures, colours, and transformation is not about hiding, it's the beginning of discovering. That curiosity is a spark that will set you on your path. That interest with transformation is more than you know. It's the start of a lifelong journey. Makeup leads to hairdressing, then to aromatherapy and massage, and then to healing therapies and the science of skin. Each skill mastered, each late night of study, each qualification earned is preparing you for something larger. When you discover cosmetic science, everything will come together. Your curiosity, your hands, your mind. In each step, each training course, you are building not just skills, but a craft, a way to help people feel seen, understood, and cared for. When skincare enters your world, everything begins to shift. You start peeling back the layers, not just of makeup, but of yourself. You realize beauty is not about covering up, but about revealing what lies beneath.
This awakening will guide you towards the science of skin, the healing touch, and the power of innovation. There will be those who doubt you. They will not understand your vision of combining science with artistry, technology with touch. But hold on to it. That vision, unyielding, brave, and ahead of its time, will become your North Star. You'll prove that skin can be approached differently, that beauty can be both intelligent and deeply human. In doing so, you will become a pioneer, paving the way for others who now follow where you once led alone. There will be times when you feel invisible, when it seems as though no one notices your dedication. Hold on. The work you're doing now is laying the foundation for a future where you'll be sought after by clients around the world, where your touch and knowledge will be transformative. Remember that the magic lies in marrying science with artistry, empathy with innovation. Your hands will heal, your formulas will empower, and your vision will change how people feel about their skin and themselves. One day, you'll see your name on products that reach far beyond a treatment room. The path ahead won't always be straightforward. There'll be challenges, setbacks, and moments of self-doubt, but each of those will sharpen your vision and give you the resilience you need to build something extraordinary. Trust that every skill you're developing, every hour spent perfecting your hands-on techniques, will one day come together in ways you cannot yet imagine. Your hardworking parents will shape you more than you know. Their resilience, their ethic of dedication, their belief in you will remind you that always that nothing worth building comes without effort. Their encouragement will give you the courage to keep going when the path feels lonely. Remember, throughout everything, to stay true to the values you held from the very beginning. Honesty, integrity, and above all, kindness. These will become your foundation. These will be the reason people trust you, why you will not only treat skin but also touch lives. And what a life it will be. You will sit face to face and touch some of the most famous people in the world, royalty, global leaders, icons of film and music. They will seek you not just for your skill, but because they feel your warmth, your sincerity, and your care. Through your business, you will welcome people from every corner of the globe, and their stories will enrich yours. You will discover that the true privilege of success is not recognition, but connection. From the shy little girl to the rebellious teen to the woman shaping a global brand, you will always carry the same heart, curious, compassionate, and determined. Hold fast to your vision, study harder than anyone else, and never stop listening, because the future ahead of you is greater than you dare to dream. And to the next generation, know that the doubts of others do not define you. Your vision, your values, and your belief in yourself are the keys to building something extraordinary. Work with integrity, lead with kindness, and never be afraid to pioneer a new way forward. If I could do it, then so can you.
Oh, I just learned something so... when you talk about that, the riches is, you know, the connections that you have built and who you have been so privileged to have met. You shine a light, Sarah, on the undercurrent of why we run our businesses, not for what everyone just sort of sees face value, but for the depths of what our businesses give us. And I'm so, so happy that you have your company.
Thank you.
I'm so happy that it gives you so what you deserve and gives you all this richness and all this beauty and colour and everything. I can see it in your eyes and I can hear it in your words. And
thank you.
Thank God for women like you paving the way for us. You know, you're a brand to be beholden. You have done the time. You know, you are there because you deserve to be there. And it helps everybody starting a business to look at brands like yourself, to look at you, Sarah, and just say, right, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to be authentic. I'm going to connect. It's going to be real. You know, my heart, I love that what you said. Your same heart, same heart, traveling all of these years in your brand. And it's just been a beautiful time to connect with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe, and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.